Well, a few more people here than I thought might be, given all the... Who had problems getting back from spring break due to all the airplane travel issues? Only one person? I thought there might be a lot more of folks who were having troubles. Welcome back from spring break. If you celebrated, a blessed Ramadan to you and yours. If not, say it to somebody else. Lecture 21, April 5th, lecture notes page 190. I did. Sir, thank you. We saw last time, as I recall, that coming up, if you want to get involved in creating accessible digital marketing for others, there's a free session open to you and employees at Kent State at that site. April 6th. So if a College of Business staff member or a College of Business faculty member has gone above and beyond to help you in a significant way, consider nominating them for the College of Business Entrepreneurship's Annual Teaching and Staff Award at either of those links by April 8th, should you have such a person in mind. If you want to get ready for Business Boot Camp on April 22nd, more information is there. Extra credit number 8 closes Thursday on its regular schedule. Mini test number 10 closes tonight on its regular schedule. And the exciting midterm number 2 opens tomorrow, Wednesday the 6th at 8 a.m. And, as I've emphasized, closes at 5 p.m. My misunderstanding from previous go-rounds, a week and a day later, Wednesday the 15th. Okay? There it is on the calendar for those that are calendar inclined. Same info. So, midterm 2, worth 70% of your course grade, covers all material from lectures 11 to lecture 20, both from the lecture and textbook. No marketing in the news, no business in the news. Questions, it's what's covered in mini test 6 to 10, which is pages 95 to 190 in the lecture notes and 165 to 351 in the textbook. Sometimes folks point out that's a big chunk, but it just also means that the final has smaller chunk if we're going to break it up in 3 chunks. The midterm exam is 50 questions, timed to last 80 minutes, standard time. Randomly drawn from the same pool of questions as the mini test. Use the review test to study. Any questions for me on midterm 2? We're all good? As expected, as promised. Webbies, are you okay? You out there? You can't use any digital material without any excuses. PACBACK Enhanced Learning number 7. Students participating on average have added 1.9 and 2.0 percentage points to their final course grade. So if you're at the margin, you just jumped yourself up a bit. Mini test 9. Average score is what we're used to, 88%. And 10 closes tonight. So business in the news. Nestle is a nice global corporation we talk about time and time. Discloses on nature, climate go hand in hand, says the Nestle's risk chief. Nestle's SA executive, who helped to put together a new framework for biodiversity reporting, said that companies should release integrated disclosures related to climate change and nature, because the two things are so interconnected. So we're seeing a bit of serious social responsibility in business. I know that we don't emphasize as much as we should that we subscribe to the United Nations sustainability goals. If you walk into off the third floor parking lot in the College of Business, you see a big display. We subscribe to those ideas, and this relates to that responsible consumption and production goal number 12 of the UN Charter on sustainability. Allison Beckwith, head of risk management at Nestle, was one of the executives involved in creating the initial framework just recently from the Task Force on Nature-Related Financial Disclosures that was recently published. The framework, devised by businesses working in collaboration with scientific organizations and non-for-profit sustainability standard setters, is meant to serve as a guide for companies about how to report on nature-related risks and opportunities. A different view of our SWOT analysis dealing with social responsibility. It follows the model of climate risk framework devised by the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures. The food industry contributes to biodiversity loss, for instance, through deforestation and soil depletion caused by farming, and relies on nature to make its products. So the negative impacts of doing business. Fashion students, you know that you too are beat up as an industry periodically for contributing to these sorts of problems through your constantly changing fashion and using packaging, etc. Well, here's somebody else. The food industry also has their issues as well. Nestle says protecting the ecosystem depends on for food ingredients is a key part of its plan to achieve net zero carbon dioxide emissions by 2050. So social responsibility in business. In December 2020, the company, Nestle, started a five-year plan to spend about $3.43 billion on climate-related initiatives, including efforts to encourage farming practices that restore soil health. So here's a business investing in responsible production. Beckwith notes that our suppliers, our farmers, are going to be impacted by climate, impacted by changing ecosystems. We need to understand their needs and the challenges that they're going to meet. So we've got a coffee plan. We've got a cocoa plan. And I think that's actually really helped to inform our net zero roadmap in terms of understanding how we can better adapt to the physical changes that are coming down the pike. Actually adapting to, say, hotter weather or more variability when it comes to water availability, and helping our suppliers to get those things done is a good thing. We need to start acting now and trying out solutions in order that the next few decades we're helping to stop the temperature rise and we're helping to preserve nature. I guess that's a motivator for me, is to see that my company takes action now. So the company and this individual are pretty serious about this idea of responsible consumption and production. We're in the topic, as you know, I guess for us, the third P of the four Ps. We've talked about product. The second P of the four Ps. We're talking about price right now. So this popping up was a good link to what we're talking about. Small businesses face challenges as costs of operation rise. Gas, shipping, and ingredients are just a few of the many expenses small businesses have to consider when they're doing business, when they're setting prices, when they're seeing where the profit is. With many industries raising prices, small businesses are being forced to make difficult decisions about how to keep their businesses afloat. So here's something we're going to talk about today, expenses in the profit formula. They, our customers, are not happy about price increases, but it is what it is, says cottage bakery owner Adrienne Dusselje. So price in her marketing mix. Customers have voiced their opinions to shops about the cost of goods rising. One thing that many customers don't think about is how much time businesses spend creating their goods. So understanding and communicating with customers about these issues is important. It's hard for small businesses when they hear that sort of thing because they're still trying to make a go of it. And with shipping going up and gas going up, it's hard for them too, says Honeybee's Creations Mercedes Schultz. How many guys have noticed, taken note of, is it Pizza Hut or Domino's that's going to pay you $3 if you pick up your pizza from them? Domino's, is that which one? Has anybody noticed that? My wife said, why is that? I said, well, with the problems getting people to come out and drive and the cost of gas going up, how many trips a day do you suppose a typical pizza place must have to make? Huge numbers. It's probably better for them to pay you $3 individually than to try to staff and pay drivers. I imagine that's their logic anyhow. Costs are going up. Cottage Bakery spends 8 hours a day baking different types of bread the customers have requested, as well as the bread of the day. So she works out of her home kitchen and makes daily trips into the Casper area, this is Wyoming, to deliver to those who order from her Facebook page. Sometimes people think it's a little pricey until they taste the bread and then they're hooked. So here's the value in that versus price for that consumer. Despite having to make changes to product prices or adding delivery fees, businesses have found support and success at markets like farmers markets, sales markets, and other sales events. Cottage Bakery has started stocking some bread and varieties of pasta at the Milk House Farmers Market, which has helped their business. So sales promotion as a part of the marketing mix and another channel of distribution. It's increased my sales, which is awesome. It's been lots of fun. Markets are an opportunity for customers to talk to the people behind the business, create relationships, and ask questions to understand what they're buying. According to Honeybee's Creations, the majority of their sales come from markets and sales events as opposed to their online shop. So typically, we're talking about e-marketing, e-commerce, the importance of digital. Here's a company that's having a lot of success in the old-fashioned way, going out and meeting the customers one-on-one at these markets. So connecting with customers non-digitally. Making those connections, having repeat customers, hearing from them how they like our products, that really gives us energy to keep doing what we're doing, says Honeybee's creation Robin Schulte. So we're developing consumer relationships. Finally, still in the domain of pricing, Lululemon forecasts strong 2022, but does plan selective price hikes. Lululemon Athletica recently forecast full-year profit and revenues above estimates as demand for athletic wear remains constant, even as people return to offices, and said it plans selective price increases on some of its products. So the relationship between demand and profit, price as an element in our marketing mix. The company also posted better than expected fourth quarter adjusted earnings despite reduced store hours due to an increase in Omicron infections. So profit last quarter, yay. Since the pandemic started, many consumers have shifted their preference to comfortable and casual clothing, helping brands such as Lululemon, whose athleisure and sportswear have now become a major part of everyday fashion. So here's the impact of the pandemic on fashion, of course, through people's norms and behavior. We're now taking modest selective price increases over the course of the year. It's a very small portion of our styles that are impacted. This will help offset some of the pressure we're seeing on average unit cost across their product lines, says Chief Executive Officer Calvin McDonald. So understanding costs across the product lines. Some make more money, some make less. Morningstar research analyst David Schwartz said as Lululemon has premier pricing all the time, having high cost, high price products is nothing new for Lululemon. They can push through that price increase without any problem because their consumers are used to paying more. So it's a premium price policy. Raising prices helps the company, especially when they're still being impacted by lingering supply chain issues. And given the fact that they don't need to be as promotional, having sales, etc., they probably have some room to raise prices. So understanding the price elasticity of demand. What happens to your demand when you bump that price up? Does it jump, stay the same, go up, go down? Price elasticity of demand. And sort of a final comment on this. Price hikes have been inevitable across the fashion industry in the last year. The ongoing catastrophic disruption to global supply chains has forced brands to raise prices. Smaller brands like Girlfriend Collective, Dog Dover, and Hill House Home, as well as large conglomerates like Capri Holdings, have all raised prices this year. So the impact of supply chain on pricing. But price hikes do hit brands differently. A company whose main appeal is dirt cheap products will feel every additional cent in a way that a luxury brand will not. The luxury brand customer is already accustomed to money is no job, no object spending. Understanding my wife and the market segments and price, little joke here was a joke. Luxury and mid-price brands offer more than product, says Julianne Prather, CMO of Retail Software Company Edited. They offer an experience and a name that people are willing to pay for. They have more price elasticity because they have an added value beyond just the product. So price elasticity of demand in the news for real. Lululemon is an in-between area in terms of price. While known for being expensive, it doesn't quite break into the luxury into that fashion portion. A $120 pair of Lululemon leggings isn't quite the same value proposition as a $1,200 pair of Prada's Nia Rosa leggings, for example. This puts the brand, as Prather puts it, in a less price elastic category than other brands. Lululemon is doing whatever it can to avoid drastic price increases. In addition to lowering discounting and focusing on the core product, it bought 49% more inventory this year than last year to get ahead of future supply chain disruptions. It has also moved much of its shipping to air freight. McDonald's says that he expects switching to air freight will increase expenses in the immediate future, but will end up saving money by the end of 2022 and help to avoid more price hikes later in the year. So understanding the interplay of all these different factors. So price, our topic for the lecture, price as marketing in the news. Picking up with lecture notes, page 190 and page 351 in the textbook, chapter 13, Building the Price Foundation. Bear with me a second. So we are considering price in the marketing mix. The last time we left off was this idea of understanding the profit equation. And as excited as I was at the time, I let you go for a few minutes early last time. So let's think about what we're talking about when we talk about profit. Profit is equal to the total revenue that you bring in minus your total costs. Okay? And what is total revenue? Well, total revenue is the unit price times the quantity sold. That is revenue. And your total cost consists of two different types of costs, your fixed costs plus your variable costs. So those are the concepts we want to keep in mind here. So let's relate these to the idea of setting price over time. First of all, we have to think about what objectives we have for our price. Off the top of your head, from what we were just talking about, or just general knowledge, what would you say Lululemon's general price objective must be? Relatively higher prices as a strategy compared to not the most expensive brands, but compared to many brands out there. It's an objective that they have in mind that's going to influence what they're doing. So you might decide that your objective is to manage for long run profits. So you can have low prices now to entice loyal consumers over time. So you're not going to make a bundle of money right now, but you expect your product life cycle to be long, and with that low price, you'll draw people in and make money over time. Or maybe your price objective is to manage for current profit. So this might result in a higher rating by analysts and increase your stock value because you're going to have higher prices right now, bringing in more profit. Or maybe you have a pricing objective of a target return on investment. Maybe you need to assure investors that this is a good investment versus other choices. After all, they could be investing in other stocks, in bonds, in other companies. They could put their money in their piggy bank. What return on investment are they going to get from you compared to other places they can invest? You might talk about sales objectives. So you might need to get a certain dollar amount in sales for the quarter, for the year. Or you might want to get a particular market share. Remember we said, Campbell's for a while had an objective of being number one or number two market share. And they're going to price accordingly to make sure that they have that going on. Unit volume, you have to hit a certain unit volume. Why? You have production plants available. You want to make sure that your production costs stay low. Long production runs mean that you have a lower unit cost. So that's your objective, say, and it's tied back to this. Other objectives, obviously, one might be just to survive. We're just trying to get through the current situation, and obviously the strong example right now is companies just trying to get through the COVID-19 devastation. Social responsibility could be an objective that influences your pricing, a goal for some companies in the Black Lives Matter, COVID-19 era, being socially responsible. We heard about Nestle's in that domain. However, we have to take note of the fact that there are certain constraints on our pricing. So there are a variety of factors that limit the range of prices that we can set. One of them would be demand, right? We know there's a relationship between price and demand. So what is the demand out there at any given time for the overall product class? So in this case, we're thinking about cars. What's the demand for cars overall should influence us in our pricing and our strategy a little bit. Suddenly, everyone in the world decides that they're going to be healthy and they're going to ride bicycles and what are these things out here called, the scooter things? What are they called? Spin scooters. Whoops, there goes demand for the entire product category. That wouldn't be good. We would have to consider that. But beyond the product category, then we have to ask about the particular product. So demand for cars overall, in a general sense, are up, but everybody wants an SUV, and we happen to be making sports cars. Well, that's going to impact what our pricing can be. And, of course, for our particular brand. So if we're selling the Bugatti Chiron, what's the demand for that look like? How does it influence our pricing? So we think about the idea of demand for the product class, for the product, and the particular brand we're selling. Pricing is also influenced by the newness of the product. What stage in the product life cycle are we in? I know you guys remember Beanie Babies. What did Beanie Babies used to sell for when they were new-ish? No one remembers? You were too young at the time? Say again?
Low.
Well, I mean, they were not 2 or 3 cents a piece. How much?
No.
$8, $9, $10, yeah. Minus the luxury ones that they put out sometimes. So early on, when it was sort of an early, if you will, fun product or maybe a fad, it was, $8, $9. Right now, you can go out there and get one for 99 cents. Or if you like to be silly, somebody's pricing it. $3,200, but they're being silly. 99 cents. Obviously, Beanie Babies, not such a popular thing anymore, way down the product life cycle. So where are you? I've talked many times, I think before by now, about flat screen TVs. First came out, $20,000 for a flat screen TV. 15, 12, 6, my first one, $3,000. I think my latest one, I don't know, $300. Things change over time. So where's your product in terms of the product life cycle and against, of course, competition? What about the idea that you're either carrying a single product or a product line? If you're carrying a product line, you have to ask yourself, how are consumers going to think about my, if you will, good, better, best product? If you have good, better, best, then you better be sure that you've separated each one from the next, or else people look at it, they say, it all looks the same to me, I'll buy the lowest price one. No, they're different. You have to make sure your pricing sees that. Or if you happen to have just different products, like our friends over at Yoplait, I don't know anything about the cost of producing yogurt. I don't know if it's actually that different, but they want you to see them differently. So our basic original Yoplait, 79 cents per 6 ounce cup. Our Yoplait Light, that's light. We're going to sell it for 66 cents per cup. Our Simplay, 90 cents a cup. And our Yoplait Greek 100, $1.29 per single serving cup. Somebody spent a lot of time, I'm sure, figuring out what people's value proposition would be for these different types of yogurt and what they might pay for that, right? So you have to think, are they different enough that people understand that they're different, and also take into account, of course, the cost. So that's going to influence our pricing as well. The cost of producing the product, we're going to get more deeply into that. And what people sometimes forget a little bit is the cost of marketing the product has to be covered too. The advertising, the social media effort, the sales promotion push, etc. We've got to cover that. And interestingly, we're constrained a little bit by the cost of changing prices and how long you're going to have them in effect. Prior to digital marketing, products were sold in catalogs. And my wife still gets a pretty big, thick stack of catalogs. Those products have a bunch of products in them, all with their prices. Those things are expensive to make. In the business world, we still have big, thick catalogs. You can't be changing prices all the time and reprinting big, thick catalogs. It costs too much. You say to me, well, in the digital era, that's not a big deal. No, but somebody still has to go in and go through all your digital sites and make sure all those prices are changed properly, right? So there's still some cost involved in these changes. Plus, consumers get irritable if you keep changing your prices all the time. So there's that. So these things constrain us a little bit. You're also constrained by the type of competitive market that you operate in. In pure competition, who can recall the example, an example of a product category in pure competition? We talked about it before from micro. What's a typical pure competition? Many, many, many sellers selling an undifferentiated product. What might that be as an example? Say again? Long Beach Church is a step up from that. You're in the general ballpark, though. Anybody else? Mike Recon? The lecture we talked about this? Nothing? Nada? All right. So typically, these are going to be things that are pure commodities, like grain, wheat, soybean, okay? Right? Ring a bell? Pure competition?
Yeah.
No differentiation? All right. Commodity-type products. How much influence over price does the individual farmer have? A lot or a little? Almost none, right? It's a market-driven situation. The market goes up, your price is better. The market goes down, your price is worse. Right now, wheat prices are up tremendously because of what's going on between Russia and Ukraine. Both of those supply something like 33% of the world's wheat, and you can't get to it right now. So existing wheat prices have gone up quite a bit. Monopolistic competition, that's more the idea of toothpaste and toilet paper. And so you have a little more ability to differentiate your product from other entities in that market. Oligopoly, our example was video game consoles. There's only a few of those folks operating against one another, and they want to keep an eye on what each other are doing, but they also can differentiate their products. And then, of course, pure monopoly, often a regulated industry like energy. So in all these cases, first of all, you're constrained by the type of competition, and then where you have some control over price, what's the competition doing? You never want to get into a price war where you lower your price to gain more market share, they look at you and they lower their price to get your market share, and you lower their, that price war spirals down. Great for the consumer, terrible for business. So what's going on with the competition is something you want to keep your eye on. So here we have it put together in sort of a chart. How much price competition do you have in pure competition? Many sellers who follow the market price for identical commodity products like wheat, etc. Almost none. How much product differentiation is there? None. The products are identical. How much advertising do you do? There's very little advertising for wheat and soybean and corn in that market. The purpose would simply be to let people know that you have the products available. Monopolistic competition. Toilet paper, toothpaste. Many sellers compete on many non-price factors, so there's some price competition over a range of prices. You can have some differentiation of your product. Colgate is different than Crest is different than Arm & Hammer. Lots of advertising purposes to differentiate your products from the competition. Oligopoly, few sellers who are sensitive to each other's price. There's some price competition. You might watch it, what the price leader is doing, or be a price follower. The extent of the product differentiation varies on the industry you're in. And the extent of advertising is to inform people about your special product, but try to avoid that idea of price competition. And finally, in pure monopoly, again, there's no real competition. They're the sole seller of the product. There's really no differentiation. They're the only one selling the thing. And there's very little advertising. The purpose might be to increase or sometimes to decrease demand for the product class. Sometimes we don't want to build a new power plant, so we want people to use less electricity. So these things are intertwined. Now we're going to think about estimating demand and revenue as we think about how we're going to set our price and how much money we're going to make. So we use something called the demand curve. Think microecon. It's a graph showing the relationship between the price of a product and the quantity sold at that price. It's going to show you the maximum number of units that will be sold at a given price. And we often use these demand curves to estimate product sales in markets where there's competition, in competitive markets. Okay? So what influences this idea of the demand curve? Well, one is consumer tastes. As consumers change their minds about things, their values change, they want more of some things and less of other things. That influences the demand at any given price point. My tired old example was tattoos. When I grew up, nobody had tattoos. It wasn't a demand thing. You couldn't sell them at a high price. You couldn't have a store everywhere. Today, everybody's got a tattoo. You want to see more? And so Tastes change. It influences demand. Price and availability of similar products. So the old example is if the price of butter goes up too much, people say, well, what else could I use instead of butter? Ah, what about margarine? And so you can simply substitute one product for the other. And consumers' income. If consumers have more money, they're willing to pay more for a good. When they have less money, that's going to influence the demand as well. So these are things we have to track and think about. Where are we standing in terms of these elements? So these factors, demand factors, determine consumers' willingness and ability to pay for goods and services. We have to be aware of them for our particular company, brand, industry, etc. So let's look at Red Baron Pizza. And here we're going to see the effect on annual sales of a change in price caused by movement along the demand curve. So we're not shifting the demand curve. There's no change in consumers' desire for pizza. There's no change in their income. We're just looking, given all other things being equal, what's going to happen to the demand for pizza? And in this case, what we see is that at $8 a pizza, we're going to sell 2 million pizzas. If I increase my price, what should happen to my demand in general for pizza? Increase price, lower demand. Lower price, we should increase our demand. So here we're going to lower our price to $6 for pizza. Bada bing, bada boom. Given this particular demand curve, we're now going to sell 3 million pizzas. You should have some idea of the demand curve for your particular industry. Is it steep? Is it flat? What's going to go on when you change your price? Now, what happens when we have a change in one of those demand factors? People's income changes. People's attitudes about pizza change. So here we're going to see a shift in the demand curve such that it moves over to the right. And instead of buying 2 million pizzas at $8 a pizza, we're now going to buy 4 million pizzas at $8 a pizza. What sort of thing could cause that to occur? What sort of thing could cause that shift to the right? Right, good. What sort of thing could cause you to sell more pizzas at the same price? People have more money. So everybody gets a raise. Congratulations. Suddenly what seemed like a good amount of money, $8, isn't that much money. More people are willing to spend. Are willing to spend that amount of money to get a pizza. We finally discovered that pizza extends your life. More people are going to buy pizza at $8, okay? So the shift in the demand curve, we find that at any particular price point, suddenly we are now selling more pizza. All right, holding that in mind, we're going to turn generally to the idea. So we're going to now think about the total revenue. The total revenue is the total money received from the sale of a product. The average revenue is the average amount of money received for selling one unit of the product. They could have just called that price, but everybody has to have a fancy name for everything. So instead of calling it price, it's called the average revenue, the amount of money for selling one unit of that product. And the marginal revenue is the change in total revenue that we get from producing and marketing one additional unit. Naively, you would say, shouldn't we always produce and market one more unit? Why would we ever not want to do that? We'll see why in just a minute. All right, so total revenue is the total amount of money received from the sales of a product. So logically, if TR is total revenue, P is price, Q is quantity, then total revenue is P times Q, which we saw earlier. And average revenue is equal to total revenue divided by the quantity we sold, which is price. All right. Marginal revenue, then, is the change in the total revenue that results from producing and selling one additional unit of the product. So marginal revenue is equal to change in total revenue divided by a one unit increase in quantity sold. And this is the slope of the total revenue curve. That's the red line there. And notice that the red line doesn't just go up and up and up and up. eventually we start getting less money earned back per unit. So here the marginal revenue is the slope of the total revenue curve, and at some point you're earning less money with that additional sale of product. Let's see how that works out for our friends here at Red Baron, okay? So let's start at $10. $10 a pizza. At $10, we're going to sell 1 million pizzas, okay? So at this point in time, price times quantity, $10 times 1 million pizzas, we're earning $10 million. Our average revenue is our price, which is $10. That's what we're selling it for. And our marginal revenue, the change in total revenue divided by the change in quantity, is $8. Okay? So here we're seeing it on the demand curve side. Here we're seeing it on the total revenue side. Sounds good? Sounds straightforward. Let's move along here. Let's drop our price to $7. What happens to our quantity sold? Bada bing, bada boom. It goes up. So at $7, we're now selling 2,500,000 pizzas. What happens to our total revenue? It goes up. And our average revenue is still $7 a pizza. But our marginal revenue, the amount of money we got for making and selling one additional pizza, has dropped from $8 to $2. Whoa, that's unexpected. How far can we continue this before it seems like a bad idea? So at $6 per pizza, indeed, quantity sold goes up to 3 million. Total revenue goes up to 18 million. Average revenue is $6. And the marginal revenue, the amount of money we got for making and producing and making and selling that one additional pizza, $0. Youch! When we finally get down to $5, yes, indeed, quantity sold goes up, $3.5 million, but our total revenue actually drops from, in this example, well, wherever you left off, to $17.5 million. So our marginal revenue, what we make on manufacturing and selling one additional pizza pie, minus $2. Might it be important for your business to know when that's happening? Yes. Is it intuitive? Not necessarily. It seems like we ought to keep making money. But as you drop price down, pretty soon, this idea of the marginal revenue goes south. And finally, if you sold at $4, you're selling 4 million pizzas. You've heard the not very funny expression, yeah, we're losing a dollar on every unit, but we'll make it up in quantity. No, you're just losing more money, right? So here you're losing $4 on the production and marketing of that additional unit. Fairly important concept. So total revenues do not simply continue to grow higher and higher as you drop your price and create one more additional unit. As our marginal revenues drop off, our total revenues drop off, and pretty soon we're losing money on the production of the next unit. What's that for your business? We also have talked about price elasticity of demand, an important thing to consider. What is the percentage change in quantity demanded relative to a percentage change in price? When you increase your price by 3%, what happens to your demand? Does it actually go up? Some odd situation. Does it stay the same? Does it go down? By how much? 1%, 2%, 3%? This is the idea of the price elasticity of demand. So the price elasticity of demand is equal to the percentage change in the quantity demanded divided by the percentage change in the price that you've made. We have elastic demand. When a 1% change in price results in a greater than 1% change in sales. So E, price elasticity of demand, is greater than 1. Okay? So in this case, a slight decrease in price results in a big increase in sales. So we drop our, you see how flat this demand curve is, as opposed to the one we were showing before? And a little drop in our price produces a big change in demand. drop our price a little bit, big increase in demand. Sounds good. What happens if we increase our price a little bit? Then we get a big drop in demand because we have an elastic price. So little decrease in price produces a big jump in sales. Little increase in price, people say, I don't need you anymore. We have an inelastic demand when a 1% change in price results in less than 1% change in sales. So E, price elasticity demand, is less than 1. So you can see how steep we have our curve here. So a slight decrease in price, about the same amount as I showed on the previous graph, results in an itty bitty little increase in sales. So the sales revenue are going to decrease for you. That may not be what you intended when you drop your price. And finally, we have just an odd, the other way is around true. When demand is inelastic, a price increase results in a relatively small drop in sales. So again, do you have inelastic demand for your product? For example, the demand in cigarettes is relatively inelastic. When you get a price increase, you don't have a huge drop. A price increase of 10% results in a drop of demand of only 4%. Why is that true in this special case? Why don't people just say, nah, it's too expensive, I quit? Because why? Because it's an addictive situation. It's a special case, and obviously less, I believe less and less people are smoking, but when you increase the price, people stay with it. So price isn't the way you're going to get rid of smoking. A unitary demand is a percentage change in price is the same as a percentage change in quantity. It doesn't mean anything in particular. It's just a number as you work through the numbers. So there's nothing particularly notable about goods that are unit elastic rather than a distinctive category. It's just a dividing line between elastic and inelastic. So the price elasticity of demand is influenced by what else you could do instead of the thing that the price just changed in. So let's ignore the pandemic for a minute. Let's pretend we haven't had a pandemic. Movie prices were going up and up and up, yeah? Who remembers how much it was to go to a movie before the pandemic-ish? $6 to $8, that's a pretty good deal, but okay, I don't know if you're taking your Friday night date out on at that, if it was that price or not. How much was the popcorn?
Popcorn, I believe, was about
$8. There you go. So the ticket was $8, the popcorn was $8. Some people were saying, I tell you what, me and my special person, that's $32, $40 to go see a movie. What else could I do? Bet I could stream a movie and have popcorn at home a lot cheaper. So we begin to have the idea of product substitutes coming along. People are saying, I don't need to spend $32, let alone the wife and two kids, forget about that, going to a movie. I'll just subscribe or I'll get a free download, right? So what are the product substitutes for your particular product? Is this thing a necessity or a luxury? And as you might guess, that's going to vary a little bit depending on your target audience. What's a necessity for some people is a luxury for other people. So you have to understand the idea of necessity and luxury. If a product is a necessity and the price goes up, what's going to happen to your demand? Is it going to go down a little or down a lot? The thing's a necessity and price goes up. What are people going to do? They're still going to have to buy it, right? The demand might go down a little bit. So you're going to have an inelastic demand, right? If it's a luxury, price goes up, people say, I tell you what, I don't need that. It's a luxury. It's an extra in my life. I think my silly example here was, right, so for me, Four Seasons would be a luxury when I go out. But you can imagine that for some people, Four Seasons, if they're a travel man, They got to go to Four Seasons as a necessity for them if they're going to travel. Not life-sustaining necessity, but still that's the way they travel versus the way I would prefer to travel. Oh, I guess, yeah, so maybe the Super 8 hotel chain might be more where I would stay. So necessity is a concept that varies by market segment. Now, if we're talking about food, it's a necessity. Type of food is different. And what about how large the cash outlay is relative to the income? That's one reason why a minute ago we said that demand curve shifts based on more income. $8 when you're not making much, that seems like a lot. Suddenly you graduate college and get a good job. Yeah, $8, it's no big deal. I could buy more. So how big is that cash outlay relative to consumers' income? So here we have clothing and gasoline. And when was that put together at $2.53 for an unloaded gallon? Which product would be more sensitive to price changes, would you say? Gasoline or fashion? Which is more sensitive to price changes? I can't hear you. 50-50 chance of being right. It's better than on a test. You only have a 20% chance of being right. How many people think that gasoline is more sensitive to prices? How many people think fashion is more sensitive to prices? The fashion group wins. Why? Because for most people, fashion is a luxury. You don't need that extra pair of jeans. You do need the gasoline to drive to work. Okay? So for most people, we would say that fashion is more price elastic. Did I say that right? It's more of a luxury than is gasoline. Now, to make your life a little more miserable, both in the class and in the business world, it turns out that the price elasticity of demand isn't fixed. Darn it. It varies. So the decrease from $10 to $9 represents an increase in total revenue, an increase in quantity sold. So we have some nice elasticity such that the drop in price, small drop in price produces a good size change in our revenue, in our amount demanded. On the other hand, when we go from $6 to $5, $5 to $4, the result is a decrease in total revenue. That's not what we hope for. And so at this point, the demand is inelastic. So we see that the price elasticity of demand changes over the demand curve as we change our price. All right, so with those things in the back of our mind, we're now going to determine the cost, volume, and profit relationships. And this is going to bring to mind the importance of understanding your costs and making sure you're covering your costs. Again, where are my accountants types? Okay, I'm going to come back to you guys in a second. All right, so what are some of the concepts here? The total cost, fixed cost, variable cost, unit variable cost, marginal cost, and marginal analysis. So how important is this idea of costs? Some of you guys watch Shark Tank occasionally, Shark Tank, and you see them pitch their deal. So 8 questions you need to answer perfectly before you go on Shark Tank from Business Insider. Question number 8, what are your costs? Investors want to gauge your ability to make high profit margins by keeping costs low or by having enough demand to keep prices high, or ideally both. You need to be able to explain what it costs you to make each product or service and the difference between that cost and the unit sales price. You should also be prepared to outline the overhead costs, such as rent, utility, expenses, and insurance. And of course, the reason that this is listed is that not all presenters know this stuff, which you know you should know because you're taking marketing 25 out of 10. So know your cost, volume, and profit relationship is important in class and in real life. All right, total cost. Total cost is the total expense that you incur in producing and marketing a product. Total cost is the sum of 2 elements, fixed cost and variable cost. So using letters, TC is equal to FC plus VC, fixed cost plus variable cost. So fixed cost is the sum of the expenses of the firm that are stable and do not change with the quantity of a product that is sold over some finite range. At some point, these things do change because you've gone from making 200 units to 1 million units. Some basic things have to change. But we're talking over reasonable ranges. Fixed costs don't change. Accounting types, what's a fixed cost? Any type, what's a fixed cost? Doesn't change over the course of making. Say again? Rent, okay. So is how much office space do you need to make 10 units, 100 units, 1,000? Now, maybe if you're making 1 million units, you need a bigger office. But over a relevant range, rent stays the same, okay? So rent, salaries for executives, insurance, these things are fixed costs. They don't change as you sell more products. So how much do you have to, I'm your executive and I have a salary of $150,000 a year. How much do you have to pay me if we sell 10 units this year? $150,000. How much do you have to pay me if we sell 100,000 units? $150,000. I'm a fixed cost. Let's say I have a better deal than that. I should have negotiated a better contract. All right, so these don't change. Variable cost is the sum of the expenses of the firm that directly vary with the quantity of a product that is produced and sold. If I am a cupcake cure, I sell cupcakes. Is cupcake cure a word? What are some of my variable costs in a cupcake? The ingredients, the sugar, the flour, the little paper thingy that you put them in, okay? Those would be, and if I make one cupcake, if you can make only one cupcake as a business, you'll need a little bit of flour, a little bit of sugar, and one of those paper doilies. If you're making 1,000, you need a lot more of those things. So, the labor that's needed to make the product, I presume it takes a lot more labor to make 1,000 cupcakes than one. The materials that are needed to make the product. What do you suppose is the most expensive part in a Tesla car? Let's see if I can get anybody else to looking for other. I'll pick you guys in a second. All right, you go ahead. Computer chips? The hardware? Anybody have another guess of what would be the most expensive cost in a Tesla? Bada bing, bada boom. The battery is the most expensive part. And so there's a lot of effort going into producing lower batteries.
Take a look at any Tesla Model 3 and try to guess what's the most expensive part to manufacture. Go ahead, we'll wait. It's okay if it's not obvious, because you can't see it without tearing a Tesla apart. Investment bankers UBS ran an analysis of such a teardown and found that the battery makes up to 40% of the manufacturing costs of any Model 3. The battery has been one of Tesla's greatest challenges in their goal to make a vehicle that's affordable to most people, yet still profitable. The ticket price for a Model 3 is currently about $42,900, while the average new car in America is selling at around $32,000. In February, Mr. Musk tweeted that the Model 3 is down to just below $35,000, but only if you include $8,000 in gas savings and a tax credit that's set to expire on July 1st. The $42,900 ticket still puts the Model 3 outside of reach for most consumers.
Certainly the first or second most expensive thing in any of these vehicles is the battery pack. And so they are acutely interested in shaving off every penny they can from the cost of that pack, because obviously the vehicle market is very competitive and they are competing with internal combustion engine cars.
Analyst Sandy Munro, who tore down Model 3s, touted its battery management system, saying that Tesla is far ahead of the competition. Model 3 batteries comes in at $111 per kilowatt hour. That's 20% cheaper than the nearest competitor. But so far, it hasn't been enough to hit the $35,000 mark without tax credits. So the company has looked for other ways to optimize battery costs, like scaling production. In 2015, the automaker announced a joint venture Gigafactory with Panasonic.
Corollary is that if you centralize a huge amount of production of one thing in one location, your supply chain is simplified, your logistics are simplified, your manpower distribution is simplified. There's a lot of other like overhead or exogenous things that can be, you know, significant in the overall like rundown of why does this cost what it costs.
So for now, Tesla will have to find some other way to get to a true price that has wide appeal in the States. Tax credits or production line tweaks can help, but without a scientific breakthrough, there are limited ways to make big savings in the battery. For consumers, that means another generation of research is due before EVs can really compete on price with their gasoline-fueled alternatives.
So if you're bringing some cognitive effort to this exercise, several things should have lit up in that little discussion. One is, what's a way to drive down the unit cost of anything, but including batteries, to have massively big, long production runs? Get a partner, create one massive plant, do it all in one place, get economies of scale. The learning curve goes whichever way it goes, up and down, down, and you have reduced costs on those batteries. So that was one thing that should have lit up. Another thing that lights up, who's your competition if you're Tesla? Well, which level are we talking about? At some level, you're competing with gas cars. You also have to think about competing with other electric vehicles. How do your costs look relative to those competitors? And then, of course, the importance of understanding the underlying cost as you think about what it's going to cost to sell your product to your consumers. The sales commissions that are paid on each unit sold. I mentioned the idea of what's it cost to produce and market the product. If you're selling, unlike me, who you only paid $150,000 a year, if your salespeople are earning commission of 10% per unit sold, the more units they sell, the more it's going to cost you. The unit variable cost is the variable cost expressed on a per unit basis. So unit variable cost is equal to the variable cost divided by the quantity manufactured, or UVC is equal to VC divided by Q. And marginal cost is the change in the total cost that results from producing and marketing one additional unit of a product. So marginal cost is the change in the total cost divided by one unit increase in quantity. It's the slope of the total cost curve. Marginal cost, slope of the total cost curve. So when you bring these things together and you want to analyze them all at once, we get the idea of marginal analysis. It's a continuing concise trade-off of incremental costs against incremental revenues. So how many of you guys know the headphones Beats by Dr. Dre? Anybody know who bought Dr. Dre out? Apple bought him out. You know how much for?
Not exactly.
It's going to be an interesting statement here a little bit. Do you know what those headphones sell for, roughly? The price range for those headphones would be? Ish? A couple hundred, depending maybe which one you're getting. What do you suppose it costs to make? If they sell for, let's throw out a number, they'll have a number up here in a second. If they sold for $150, what do they cost to make, would you say? Well, then you're cheating. I'm just looking for an opinion. Who has an opinion? What you got?
I think it was like
$25? $32? How many people think it might be higher? If they're selling for $150, it might be higher than $32. How many people think it'd be lower than $32? Lower than $25? Around $25. Let's see what the answer is for the. Oh, by the way, this is from what used to be one of my favorite folks, Rover's Morning Glory, that business program in Cleveland in the morning show, if you know it. Oh, come on. All that lead in, and you're going to screw around with me.
Doogie can swindle $1,000 from an intern, but she still can't convince him to. We're back with Rover's Morning Glory.
What were you just asking Doogie about? Something about Beats by Dre?
Yeah.
What is that?
It came out what the real cost. I was fascinated by what something really costs.
To make?
Right, and okay. Then what they charge.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, you want the
Give me the info. These Beats by Dre headphones, first of all, they really don't sound that great, to be honest with you.
Everybody has them. You go to the gym, you walk past a bus stop, everybody has these things on.
Yeah, they really don't sound that.
I pause to tell a non-testable story, but it's a true story. So my kid is out in the real world. He's up in Manhattan. He's in New York City. He's paying attention to what's going on in the big financial office he works in. He wants a headset. Okay, what do you want? So I'm looking up headsets, like you were maybe looking up, and there's these Beats by Dre, and there's Bose headsets. I say, hey, dude, the Bose headsets are really sturdy. They're well-built. They have much better sound. A little more expensive, but, you know, I'll pay for them. What do you want? He wants Beats by Dre. Why? Because he says, look around my office. Everybody has them. There's the idea of what people, you know, want, their particular taste at a particular point in time. Eventually, his Beats by Dre broke and he bought Bose.
Great. And they sell for like $300, right?
The cheapest ones you can get are $200. But they go up to $700.
$200 to $700.
Why $700? What's the difference? What could you do?
I think they have like Lil Wayne wears them. Lil Wayne. I think there's like little crystals or diamonds on them or whatever. I just seen some really fancy ones.
Ooh, now, okay. How much do they cost to manufacture, Dieter?
You want
to
guess?
Ooh. $200 to $700?
Yeah, and they sold the company for what?
$1 billion or something, right? Or $2 billion, or
I think $3.2 billion.
$3.2 billion, okay. To Apple. Apple bought it. How much did the Beats by Dre headphones cost to manufacture?
$65.
No, get the hell out of here. No way. Not that high. No way. Not a chance. They're plastic, douche. They're plastic. I would say they cost, now one thing that people don't consider, though, when you might see the cost, oh, this is what it costs to make, and look how much they charge. Well, what about all of the management, the marketing, insurance, or God knows what else, legal fees? That of course, no, that's not included in there. So that's going to bump up your actual cost per unit. But the manufacturing cost, what it costs to make these things, is probably in the range of $10 to $12.
No, I'll go down to 50. I'll give you $50. If it's 200, so it's $150 profit per one.
Jeffrey wants to pipe.
I'm gonna put my guess at $20 for the manufacturer.
Mm-hmm. All right. Go ahead. Give me the rundown. What does it cost to manufacture Beats by Dre headphones?
So Rover was the closest. They sell for $200 to $700, like I said, but the actual cost to make, $14.
$14?
Yeah. So look at that markup.
Oh, that's incredible, isn't it?
That's why they're making so much green.
Wow.
Oh,
now,
wow.
Again, you do have to put the marketing. You think it's cheap to get LeBron James or someone to be in a commercial
and
to produce that commercial and to buy the airtime for that? Those don't factor into the cost. So your cost per unit may jump up to $50 or something for all we know. But the actual cost to make these things is $14.
$14.
Wow, indeed. So there you go. $14 to make them, manufacture them. And then Rover does a great job for me, even though he didn't take my course, of reminding us that that's the manufacturing cost. That doesn't include all the other things, including the marketing cost as well. But still, $14 to manufacture, plus tax, tip, shipping, marketing. So, the way we bring this together is through break-even analysis. Break-even analysis is a technique that analyzes the relationship between the total revenue that you're bringing in, the amount of money your sales bring in, and the total cost, what it costs you to bring in those sales. And it helps you to determine the profitability at various levels of output. Okay? Break-even analysis. Critical thing to be able to do for your product line, your brand, your small business. So a break-even point is the quantity at which total revenues and total costs are equal. So if total revenues are the same as total cost, how much money are you making? Thank you. Goose egg. If that's where you are, you're at the break-even point. You haven't made any money yet. So we could do it in dollars or units. If we're doing it in units, the break-even point is equal to the fixed costs, my salary, rent, etc., divided by the unit price minus the unit variable cost. So FC divided by P minus UVC. We've looked at those meanings before. So we are a picture frame store. Mary Bricker downtown? Picture frame? And our price per picture frame in our particular simple example is $120 per picture frame sold. I assume that means, you know, all nicely put together as well. So at zero, zero quantity sold, we make zero revenue. Our unit variable cost, how much it costs to put the thing together, hypothetically, I guess it's silly at that zero number, is $40. Our total variable cost, let's move down to the next one. The first one's silly. So we sell 400 pictures. Our price per unit is $120. So our total revenue, $4,800, $48,000, 120 times 400. Our unit variable cost is $40. That stays the same. Our total variable cost is equal to our variable cost, our unit variable cost times our quantity. So that's $16,000. And our fixed cost, which don't change no matter how much we sell, is $32,000. So our total cost is our fixed cost plus our variable cost. So we've got $32,000 plus $16,000, $48,000. And in the example of selling 400 picture frames, our total revenue, $48,000. Total cost, $48,000. Profit, zero. So we aren't making any money yet. So our break-even point is that $32,000 in fixed costs divided by the $120 minus the $40, and that gives us a 400-unit break-even point. All right, that would be pretty important for us to know. Graphically, we can put it together into a chart. Yes, I can. So just to mumble over it while you're writing it down, the fixed cost doesn't change, $32,000, no matter how much we're making over a reasonable range. The unit variable cost also doesn't change on an individual unit. And the price minus the unit variable cost, as you can see, is $80. So with fixed cost of $32,000, divide that by your price minus your unit variable costs are $80, and you break even at 400 units. We there? So we can do it visually, if you like. So what would this line likely represent? Would it? Fixed cost. The number, but that's our fixed cost, 32,000, yep. So it doesn't change over time. The variable cost goes up as we sell more. So the total cost is the fixed cost plus the variable cost. That's the purple line going up and up. Here's our total revenue right off of the table that we just had a minute ago. And so, graphically, what do we have right there? Break-even point, as it happens at 400 units. All right? So to the left of that, how are we doing? We're not doing well. To the left of that, we're losing money on what we're doing. All right? And to the right, what do we have? Profit. The sweet spots we want to be in. So, if we were able to get 1,000 frames going, fixed cost stays the same, variable cost at 1,000 frames, it's $400 each, is $40,000. Total cost is $72,000. Revenue is $120,000. And our profit at 1,000 units, $48,000. You got to know, people, what your costs are, variable and fixed, and how much you expect to sell at each amount of money, and then know whether or not you have any chance of making money. What should that number look like? All right, and there it is. I think I stole that from the book. All right, all those numbers making me confused. I think we'll call it a day. Did I mention that there's a midterm that opens tomorrow? If not, I should have mentioned that. Midterm 2 opens tomorrow, and Mini Test 10 closes tonight.